Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
In the summer of 2022, the Great Salt Lake was at a distressingly low, record-breaking elevation. Researchers traced the records back to 1850, and they saw the lake had lost nearly three-quarters of its water, 60% of its surface area, and its ecosystem had begun to collapse. Now, most scientists seem to agree that climate change was only a secondary contributor to the decline of the lake. The real culprit, they believed, was human consumption, unsustainable water use, and excessive diversions of the lake's tributaries. In other words, the problem wasn't out of anyone's hands. Something could be done to save the lake. And with that in mind, in the weeks before the opening of the 2023 legislative session, a group of advocates and scientists signed on to a report published by Brigham Young University. It wasn't a scientific paper in the formal sense. It hadn't been peer-reviewed or published in a journal. In fact, they described it as a briefing for lawmakers. But whatever you call it, here's the part that caught most everyone's attention. It said the lake's drop had been accelerating since 2020, an average deficit every year of 1.2 million acre feet. And if you follow that trend line, the lake runs out of water in 5 years. Here's how they put it in the report. If this loss rate continues, the lake as we know it is on track to disappear in 5 years. 5 years. The possible fate of the lake was no longer abstract. Scientists had done the equations and come up with a possible timeline that was terrifying. The journalist and climate scientist Matthew LaPlante was working on his PhD at Utah State when he first read about the report.
And my phone started lighting up, and it was a bunch of other graduate students. You know that emoji with the rolling eyes? It was a lot of that, you know, because immediately there was something about it that just didn't feel right. You know, this is not the way that we talk about climate, you know, that in 5 years something's going to happen. And so, of course, that sends us to the report. And the report's more nuanced than the reporting on the report was. But even then, there were some things about the report that just went, well, that's an interesting way to come to that conclusion. Taking a small number of years and extrapolating from those years. Taking a small number of years that were drought years, really extreme drought years. So that was the first thing. It's just this initial kind of like, I don't know. The second thing that happened was that I had a conversation with my advisor and collaborator, Simon Wong. And Simon said, you know, in 5 years, when this doesn't happen, people aren't going to remember which scientist said it happened. They're just going to remember that some scientists said it happened. And we're going to be wrong in their eyes, and they're not going to trust us. That stuck with me. And then the snow comes.
New attendant and I, just 6 months ago, we were coming out of one of the hottest summers on record. Farmers and ranchers across the state were out of water. Lawns were turning brown.
But over the winter, Utah received an historic amount of snow.
Troy Broston, hydrologist with the snow survey team, is thrilled with the amount of snow at the Atwater Snowtill site.
12.5 feet. That's pretty darn phenomenal.
Yeah, the director of the Snow Hydrology Lab at the University of Utah could have never predicted her equipment at the top of Little Cottonwood Canyon would ever be buried by snow.
No one could have predicted that we would, that one winter could recharge so much of our deficit all at one time.
That has helped bringing the Great Salt Lake back from the brink.
We were kind of like talking out like how we were going to talk about this in 5 years. And it wasn't 5 years. The weather gods have decided that we're going to be talking about this winter, immediately after this report. And sure enough, within months, Governor Cox is calling out these scientists and criticizing their work.
I believe that doom and gloom does not result in change. I believe it has never inspired change. And I think that is core to our human nature. When we tell people that the sky is falling, what most people do is they give up. Just think, well, there's nothing I can do about it. What can me, my one little thing, if the Great Salt Lake is already done, if it's already dried up and we're all going to die from toxic dust, then I'm just going to go ahead and water my lawn.
And then a few months later, he's on National Public Radio calling the report a joke.
That prediction is laughable. It's a joke, and everybody knows it's a joke. They were never serious about that. They know it was not going to dry up in 5 years. That's the doomerism that is terrible for people.
What came next was the science part for me, which was, and again, in collaboration with Simon Wong, was this question of, is there a better way to model what the futures for the Great Salt Lake might look like? And when we look at it that way, what we see is, yeah, what the models suggest, these really high-powered simulations of potential futures, is that there are some scenarios where the lake goes away drastically in a matter of a few short years, maybe a decade. But those are outlying scenarios. And the majority of the scenarios say probably the lake continues to decline under moderate warming scenarios moving forward. To me, it's still scary, but it's not as immediate, not as sexy. And even if you don't say it, right? Like, they never said, by the way, the lake definitely will be gone in 5 years. Never in the report. It does make a strong warning that could happen. And then that filtered through the media, and this is my journalism hat, my communicator's hat, that filtered through the media becomes scientists warn Great Salt Lake may disappear in 5 years. A little bit stronger. And then you filter it through social media, and it's like, the Great Salt Lake's going to be gone in 5 years. And then, just the way our brains work, that's how people remember it. And when I talk to people in Utah and I say, you remember a couple of years ago there was a report about the Great Salt Lake? What was going to happen to it? And they go, oh yeah, 5 years. It was going to be gone in 5 years. Terrified me. That's what we remember. And that's really a rough place to be. You also might be wrong. And in people's mind, you're probably going to be wrong. And then they're going to remember, as my colleague Simon said, they're not going to remember which scientist said it. They're just going to remember that they can't trust scientists.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. As you can hear, as a climate scientist himself, Matthew LaPlante has his own theory about the future of the Great Salt Lake in a warming planet. He's the co-author of a peer-reviewed paper that he uses as material for a series he reported for the Salt Lake Tribune and Utah Public Radio, along with the journalist Clarissa Casper. The articles raise questions about whether the report published by BYU actually considered all the factors in the complicated calculus of climate change. And it explores the costs and benefits of alarming the public, especially if your timeline goes off the mark. Here's Matthew LaPlante again.
When someone decides as a scientist that they are not only going to seek out answers about the world, but take a position as to what that means for what we should do politically and socially, how much responsibility do they have to getting that right on the nose? Because science is never right on the nose. But scientists are given, have been given. I like to say this a lot, by the way. Like, a lot of people talk about like the lack of trust in institutions. But polls still show, surveys still show, Americans and people around the world still have a high degree of trust for scientists. I'd like to think that that's earned. You know, like we've done a good job in the past. We've been honest brokers in the past, and so people trust us. I hope that continues. But increasingly, there's this question about how much, you know, like once we discover something, especially if it's something related to climate and you know, impending disaster, right? Like, should we talk to people about that in ways that move from just I'm telling you what the science is to I'm telling you what we should do? So I wanted people to wrestle with that.
Well, I want to because I want people to pay attention to the particulars of the reporting in the piece. I want to make sure people understand what it is you're saying, and you're not in the piece, you're not disputing that climate change is a real thing. Right?
Absolutely. Okay. Yeah, absolutely, positively not.
All right.
Climate change is real. We're the cause. It's going to mess stuff up.
And you're not suggesting that climate change, in fact, you are suggesting this, which we'll get to. You're not suggesting that climate change is not going to have a negative impact on Great Salt Lake.
Correct.
You're also not disputing that, you know, higher concentrations of salinity caused by a shrinking lake would drastically affect the biological function of, you know, the creatures who anchor that ecosystem. You're not raising any of the questions that were coming up in 2022 about if that lake goes away, crashing brine shrimp populations, therefore, you know, migratory birds, therefore arsenic in the air. You're not questioning any of that either.
No.
You're also not saying, here's the last disclaimer, that any of these scientists were acting in bad faith.
Absolutely not. No. No, I'm not. And look, I don't think anybody likes to see their name in print along with anything that's, you know, even if they say, like, even if you say, like, you weren't acting in bad faith, but perhaps you could have done things differently. Nobody likes that.
Yeah.
Right. But absolutely not. Like, I think that what they saw in the way that they were looking at it was something resembling impending doom. And they wanted people to know.
All right. Let's go to the paper itself. 34-page paper, as you say in your article, written by a team of dozens of researchers and activists. What does it say? In fact, let me read what it says, because this is part of the nuance. If nothing changed, they make this prediction, right? And here it is. The lake would be on track to disappear in the next 5 years. So what are they saying in this piece?
What they're saying, and there's two ways to look at this too. And they're actually, the five-year claim is made twice in the report. And at one point in the report, it says the lake as we know it is on track to disappear. And this is very kind of like wibbly wobbly timey wimey, right? Like what does that mean? The lake as we know it now, as we knew it 20 years ago, what does that mean? But I think to give them the benefit of the doubt, it means the what we have decided the healthy functioning of the lake is. And there's certainly like a temporal bias to that, right? Like the lake as we know it is the lake as we have known it since we have been here and been watching the lake. The lake's been up and down and left and right for, you know, millennia. So there's that. And then there's another place in the report that's not even that nuanced. It says the lake is on track to disappear.
Right. And that's the one that people paid attention to.
Big time.
Yeah.
Big time. And to the credit of the authors, I think that when they did media, and they did a lot of media after this, when they did media after this, they tried to introduce some of that nuance. I also don't think they pushed back super hard against the five-year notion. They didn't say, well, look, it's a very minuscule probability, but it could happen. Because that was the thing that was getting people to pay attention.
So it worked.
I think it worked.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think, you know, like, bro, we talked to Brian Steed, who's the Great Salt Lake Commissioner, also a colleague at Utah State University. And Brian, you know, who works directly for Governor Cox, says, he also oversaw this thing, the Great Salt Lake Strike Team, which was a bunch of researchers and politicians and activists and people trying to figure out what the things that they could do to really protect the Great Salt Lake would be. And he's like, well, we came up with different conclusions. We didn't see that sort of risk. But it got people talking. It got people thinking. It got people acting. And so the Great Salt Lake Commissioner, even though his group had concluded, yeah, not 5 years, he didn't mind so much. He said on the record, at least, he says, you know, didn't mind so much that at least the conversation was happening because the conversation needs to happen.
So it made sense, right? On some level, 5 years. Like, they didn't just take that out of nowhere. They saw a trend line. They did the math. And that's where it was headed. But what was wrong with that kind of thinking? One of the things that your article is about is that there were just other factors that they also should have plugged into the equation.
Yeah, Yeah. Well, I mean, let's take the trend line first, right? So we are in a long-term cycle of drought. That drought has probably been aggravated, likely been aggravated by climate change. And in particular, from about 2020 to 2022, we were experiencing one of the most heightened periods of extreme drought in the basin surrounding the Great Salt Lake that we have seen since observational records began 100 years ago.
As you put it in the piece, it spiked.
It spiked.
The drought.
It spiked. And you can see this. Right? We have these really great charts that show us like the level of drought. And look, those 2 years were bad. Those were really, really bad. Now, those periods of drought have happened before. They happen every 10, every 20 years. You'll get a spike like that. That's just part of the natural variability and, again, may be accentuated by climate change. So, but that was the period that they used to derive the trajectory for the lake going away.
Yeah.
And they say in their report, they're very clear about it, right? Like, since 2020, the lake has lost this much acre feet per year. And then you really, like, the math is very simple at that point,
right?
You multiply that many acre feet of loss times the volume of water.
Yep.
And lo and behold, you get to desiccation in about 5 years. But that would have required that spike of drought to continue, as well as, and this is not to be dismissed also, all of the diversions that we're already doing that I think even people who are pretty skeptical about the dangers of the lake would say, like, hey, man, like, if we didn't divert so much water, that might not be a bad thing, right? Like, can we use our water better? Great. That wouldn't, like, even the most conservative people on that in that school would probably say, like, yeah, if we can use water better, that would be good. And then you have people like me who are like, yeah, it would be really good. And you have people like them who are like, yes, it would be really good if we could stop diverting water. The diversion is part of it. But also the drought, the spike in drought was part of it.
Climate, and they didn't take that into account?
It does not appear so.
Okay.
It does not, at least not in that report, right? Like they talked about the long-term cycle of drought, which we have been in since about the year 2000. Mm-hmm. They talked about the overall trajectory downward for the lake, which, you know, more or less we've been in since the mid-1980s when the lake was so big that we started diverting water away from it. Which now, like, I tell my students that now, and they're like, we did what? Why would we do that? Right? Well, because there was so much water 35 years ago.
We were trying to pump water out of that thing.
Yeah, I mean, like, so they talked about that. And they're clear about their methodology,
yep.
Right? They weren't hiding anything, but they were accentuating some things.
Matthew LaPlante, he's a climate scientist and an associate professor of journalism at Utah State University. Along with Clarissa Casper, he co-authored a three-part series for the Salt Lake Tribune and Utah Public Radio about the future of the Great Salt Lake. The reporting was also produced as a series for the podcast Undisciplined. We have links to all of that on our website, radiowest.org. We should also note that we've invited Ben Abbott, one of the lead authors of the BYU report, to join us to respond to LaPlante's critique. You can hear that interview next week on the show. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. If you're a scientist in 2023 and you were following the drop in elevation of the Great Salt Lake, and that trend line told you that at a deficit of 1.2 million acre feet a year, the lake would disappear in 5 years, of course you would say something, wouldn't you? Well, that's exactly what happened. In the weeks before the legislative session, a group of scientists and advocates signed on to a report published by BYU that issued that warning. But then the snow started to fall. Today in the program, we're discussing a series of articles in the Salt Lake Tribune and Utah Public Radio that asks if these scientists got it wrong and if their warning backfired. The stories were reported by Clarissa Casper and Matthew LaPlante. LaPlante is our guest throughout the hour. I want to get to some of the questions you raise about the ebbs and flows of precipitation in the mountains here. and how difficult it is to account for it. Because this is a really important piece about the series. Why is it so difficult to predict snow and rainfall around here? Because one of the things you mention in the piece is that there is a system that's available to Utah scientists, to scientists everywhere in, around the state, and it uses these large number of models. It's called the North American Multi-Model Ensemble.
NMME, right.
So the
North American Multi-Model Ensemble was created a little more than a decade ago.
Right.
And it takes all of these different computer simulations of the atmosphere, which have been shown to be better in some places and worse in some places. And it says, like, look, like, where it is proven to be better, we will use this part of the model. And where it is proven to be worse, we'll discard that. And so it's like the creator of the model, or one of the creators of the models, said, you know, it's like a judicious cancellation of errors, right? We look at where it's been right, we look at where it's been wrong, and we really focus on where it's been right. And when you do this, this ensemble gives pretty accurate estimations of coming seasons of precipitation and temperature moving from 1 to 5 months in the future.
Yeah. In certain places.
In certain places.
Right. So it's
right.
So it gives a pretty good picture of the rainfall in Florida, where you're worried about hurricanes and floods. It tells you in Iowa and Illinois what to expect in terms of flooding of the rivers there or whatever.
And not so good in the Mountain West.
But not so good here.
Here's why. So this is largely predicated on the two-ton gorilla in climate, which is the El Niño Southern Oscillation. And so that's the cycles of La Niña and El Niño that we talk about a lot.
Right.
And when a La Niña event is happening, cooler waters in the tropical Pacific, it starts a chain reaction that most often, not always, but most often, results in warmer and drier weather across the southern part of the United States and cooler and wetter across the northern United States. And then broadly speaking, El Niño is the opposite. Right between those areas is this band of states. I call them the liminal band of states. Mm. And this is basically inland California, northern Nevada, northern Utah, Colorado, Kansas, where things can kind of go either way.
Why?
Because the way
a model can't account for that.
No, not
but
yet.
For some right. reason, something is weird about this liminal period in the country.
Yeah, yeah. It's the circulations that shift as a result of temperature changes in the tropical Pacific,
right,
result in a shift to the behavior of the jet stream. The jet stream is just like moving like another two-ton gorilla, right? Like moving large amounts of precipitation and also really fixing high and really large areas of high and low pressure, which dictate weather patterns. And just the way that this Rube Goldberg contraption in the environment works is that, like, you know, the dominoes fall and then the ball rolls and then like the balloon goes up and the flame and all of that, right? Really is pretty situated in the southern United States and the Pacific Northwest. But it's not so well situated here. And so if it's a really big La Niña, we might feel that effect. Or if it's really big El Niño, we might feel that effect. But it has not proven to be robustly predictable in the way that it has in other places in the country.
So in this sense, the scientists and activists who wrote that paper, they could be let off the hook for the fact that, look, there isn't a good model that's going to give us an exact prediction. We'll just sort of go by what looks to be a trend line.
I hear all the time from people, because the association between this report and then the snowpocalypse, as we call it, that happened right afterwards is pretty stark, right?
Yes, yes.
Like the report gets released and then we get just months and months of snow. And so a lot of people are like, well, gosh, didn't they even know that was coming? Why would they have done that? Why would they have done that? And the answer is no, they didn't know. And it wasn't because they just missed it. None of us knew. The models did not indicate that we were going to have a snowpocalyptic winter. Nothing suggested that, because it's really not at this point in our understanding of the atmosphere. We haven't figured out what will clue us in to what the coming winters will look like in Utah. We get some clues, but nothing robust. And so, yeah, they didn't know. But they also, you know, the caveat is true, right? Which is they also didn't know it was going to be another year of extreme drought. And the extreme drought is one of the elements that was leading to the desiccation of the lake. Not the only element, but one of the elements that was leading to the desiccation of the lake was this spike in drought in those basins.
You say in the article that what the scientists didn't quite get right was chaos. Hmm. Let's talk about that. Tell us about the history of the butterfly effect and how stochastic that notion plays into the story.
So there's this guy that everybody learns about when you study climate science, Ed Lorenz. And actually, I got a great – I think it's a great story about Ed Lorenz. A few years ago, I worked on a study with a couple of colleagues. The lead author was Jacob Stuvenvolt Allen. He's a fellow grad student at USU. We wanted to know if there was a connection between the series, really anomalous series of typhoons in the far western Pacific, three that made landfall in Korea in the matter of 10 days, which is crazy. Like, Korea usually gets one typhoon a season, and it got three in 10 days. And then just a few days later, this wind event in the Pacific Northwest that everybody in Utah remembers, all the downed trees, all that. Everybody remembers that?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, what happened simultaneous to that happen in Utah was that in the Pacific Northwest, that wind spike caused a conflagration, right? Just like fires everywhere all at once in the middle of the night, just boom, fires everywhere. And you can see it on satellite imagery. It's crazy. Like, you just have like the normal amount of fires, the normal amount of fires, and then this wind spike. And then all of a sudden, it's just like the devil snapped his fingers and everything is up. Wow. And so we wanted to explain, is there a connection here? And in order to do that, you have to talk about chaos, right? You have to talk about the chaos in the atmosphere. And in order to do that, you got to talk about this guy, Ed Lorenz. And Ed Lorenz is the father of chaos theory. This theory about the world that there's like, you know, quite frankly, we're never going to be able to predict anything because of chaos. Because, you know, as Ed put it sort of famously, a flap of a butterfly's wings in Brazil can cause a tornado in Texas. Although before he settled on the butterfly analogy.
This is the best part.
I love this part, right? Yeah. Like, before he decided that butterfly was more poetic, and that was because a guy, then actually that happened sort of as a matter of chaos too. Ed was in transit going to a conference where he was going to present on chaos theory. And they had to come up with a title for his talk. But they couldn't get a hold of him. Right. So like sort of this chaotic event that nobody could have predicted. And so this guy who was putting on the conference was like, we're going to call it the butterfly effect. Instead of using what Ed had originally used and had been using for a couple of years at that point to describe it, which was the flap of a seagull's wings, which I love because the seagull, of course, is the state bird of Utah. So here's what we know about the flap of a seagull's wings. You can't account for all of them. You just can't. And even if you could track back a tornado in Texas to the flap of a seagull's wing somewhere else, you wouldn't be accounting for all the other seagulls in the system, which is what makes meteorology so complex and makes us all pull out our hair and make us all like really angry at the meteorologist on our TV when, you know, she said that it was going to be 72 degrees and instead it was 62 degrees, or they said it was going to be clear skies and instead we had rain. To some extent, we can be pretty accurate within days. You start going out days to weeks and you get really into the area where just chaos takes over. Yeah. So much so that predicting anything weather-related, that's the immediate meteorology that you're going to experience from day to day. If you're out more than 10, 14 days, you might as well just look at what last year's weather was.
Wow.
Because that's how much chaos is in the system. And this applies also to climate to some extent too, right? Like, we can't tell you for sure that a coming season, even based on what we know about El Nino and La Nina and those connections, you know, even in places where those connections are really, really strong, which they're not here in Utah, but they are in other places in the world, right? We can't tell you for sure. Now, I will say, like, we're getting better and better at it. our trajectory, the models that we built 30 years ago, and by we, I mean some scientists who were smarter than me and older than me, the models we built 30 and 40 years ago have turned out to be pretty accurate globally. You know, maybe hemispherically, maybe continentally, maybe even state by state. But, you know, weather and climate impacts us at really micro levels. We're just now getting to the point where our models are suggesting what we think might happen in those sort of micro levels. What's going to happen to, for instance, the Great Salt Lake, yeah. which for as big of a lake as it is a pretty small area on the globe. We're getting better at it, but we're not there yet. And so we don't have all of the answers to these questions.
One of the things you do in the piece is raise the question of, are there other alternatives that will help us decide the future of the lake? Like, what's going to happen to Great Salt Lake? Is it going to dry up in the next 5 years, 20 years, 30 years, by the end of the century, whatever it might be? And one of the alternatives that you offer is, let's look at groundwater.
Yeah.
Let's talk about that, because one of the things the piece does is raise questions about the sort of the conventional wisdom about snowmelt and runoff. How does runoff really work? I know how most of us think about it. And maybe you could talk about the way most of us think about it and then tell us how it actually works.
Yeah. So I, for a long time, like most people, assumed you get a big snow and rain year. And in a place like where we live, where everything flows down to a lake, if it's rain, it's going to do so almost immediately in a matter of days. And if it's snow, well, it's going to freeze up there, but then when it melts off, you know, so 3 to 4 months from now, it's going to head to the lake. And that is a large part of what happens. Well, two things happen. One, evaporation happens. So you could have a really high snowpack, but then if you get a really, really warm spring, like, yeah, that's going to melt that snow fast, but it's also going to evaporate a bunch of that snow. Yeah. So that's one thing that can happen. And then the other thing is a lot of that water seeps into the mountain and it stays there for a really long time. Across the West, the average is something like 7 years before it winds up in a terminal place like the Great Salt Lake. And in some places, that could be a little less. In some places, it can be a lot more. Water can go into the ground and just get stuck there. There's water up in our mountains that's been there for thousands and thousands of years and will be there for thousands and thousands of years until there's a big geological shift that, you know, shakes things up.
Yeah.
And then it'll be released a little more. So on average, we're talking about 7 years. The reason why this is really important is related to some work that a colleague of mine, Christy Hakala, did, also from Utah State University. She's now a climate scientist in Melbourne. She wanted to know if one of our models for groundwater was accurate. And, you know, how do you do that? Well, you look at the levels of wells. So she took all of these hundreds and hundreds of wells all across the Great Salt Lake Basin, and she looked at the levels of those wells, the rising and falling of those wells over decades and decades. And then she looked at what the model said happened. And lo and behold,
It lined up.
Yeah, it lined up. So we know that our groundwater, our computer simulation of groundwater in this area is pretty good. That's super useful because there is also a correlation between the rising and falling levels of the Great Salt Lake and groundwater. Not from year to year, but like if you take a span of years, right? And so now, because we don't have a model specific to the Great Salt Lake, we can use this groundwater model to tell us some of the trajectories moving forward. And this is one of the things that wasn't reflected in this BYU report. And again, they're very clear about it. It's in the report. It says we did not account for groundwater. So it could be worse than this or better than this. If the ground was parched, if the groundwater was not there at all, it could have been even worse. But that's an important factor. The immediate input of groundwater, other scientists have estimated, is probably around 15%, which is to say like water that comes from the ground and goes on the lake. That's about 15% of the lake.
Wow.
But scientists from the University of Utah have said, yeah, that might be true. But also that doesn't account for the fact that the water also goes into the ground way up in the mountains. And then it stays for a couple of years. And then long before it gets to the lake, it winds up in one of the streams or rivers that goes down to the Great Salt Lake. And so if you account for all of that, we're talking about more like 50% of the total water that winds up in the lake. That's not my research. That's other people's research. But that's the estimate. And so groundwater is an important factor for two reasons. One, it makes up a big portion of the lake. And two, it helps us have an idea of what the potential trajectories moving forward are.
Matthew LaPlante. He's a climate scientist and associate professor of journalism at Utah State University. He co-authored a three-part series for the Salt Lake Tribune and Utah Public Radio, along with Clarissa Casper. We should also mention we've invited one of the lead scientists of the BYU report, Ben Abbott, to join us on the show next week. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for Radio West comes from our members. Find out how at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the journalist and climate scientist Matthew LaPlante. We're talking about a series he co-reported with Clarissa Casper for the Salt Lake Tribune and Utah Public Radio. The articles raise questions about a report on the future of the Great Salt Lake published by BYU. So there's this question about whether the dominant player in all of this is, you know, the human-caused alteration of our climate or just the reality of natural variability. And I think what you're saying is it's both, right?
Oh, yeah.
But I want to read something from the piece. You write that the most – here's from what you write in the piece. You say the most probable time frame for complete desiccation of the lake – could potentially begin around 2045, and that could simply happen as an outcome of global warming, irrespective of whether diversions for cities, industry, and agriculture are curtailed.
Yeah.
So no matter what we do about diversions, which is the ongoing conversation and has been for the last several years, global warming is just going to have an impact on the drying lake. There have been reports, and we reported on this here at Radio West. In 2020, there were these two researchers at Utah State University, Sarah Null and Wayne Wurzbach. According to our reporting, I'm not sure how you think of them. They're, you know, thought of as, you know, really the experts on the hydrology of the Great Salt Lake. And they published this report that said that it was not climate change that was drying up the lake. It was these water diversions. Here's a quote from the report. Climate change to date has not noticeably influenced the lake level. And a lot of people really connected to that, to say, look, if you think this is just the climate change and we can't do anything about it, that's not the case. There are these diversions that are absolutely having an impact on the lake. And people went with that. Mm. And people are still going with that. So what are you saying in your reporting? What's the reality there? Because you say it seems like the opposite. It seems like what you're saying is it's not the diversions. That has an impact, but sorry, this is climate change. Or am I wrong? What are you saying?
It's A plus B plus C.
Okay.
Yeah. Natural climate variability continues to be the dominant factor in most of what we experience as weather and climate on this planet. That is impacted by climate change. So let's say that the lake's levels, you know, for the last 150 years have varied between 1 and 10, which is going to create some units here. Okay. They vary between 1 and 10 normally. That's natural climate variability. Sometimes we're going to get a 1, sometimes we're going to get a 10, and usually we're going to be, you know, 4, 5, 6. Climate change, we layer on top of variability. And climate change might tell us that, you know what, once in a while, the lake's going to vary between negative 1 and 11. And if we don't get off this addiction we have to greenhouse gases, it might be negative 2 to 12. So variability remains the dominant factor. So our past of variations in the lake have ebbed and flowed within this 1 to 10 variability. it doesn't take much climate change to impact that. The model that we used in the research paper that this reporting in the Tribune was partially based on, our models are predicated on the idea of a moderate warming scenario. So more greenhouse gases, more warming. Under those situations, within the span of the different simulations that we look at, hundreds and hundreds of simulations, the majority of the simulations say the lake under those circumstances will continue to decline. Not precipitously, but slowly and gradually through the middle of the century, at which point, according to the models, which are imperfect, it probably looks like it's going to level out a little bit. There remains in those models, in those simulations, these outliers that say total desiccation, and also some outliers, not as many outliers, by the way, that say we're going to have another 1980s event, which is going to be crazy, right? The vast majority of the simulations say a slow continual decline. You know, much like the BYU report didn't account for some things, that simulation doesn't account for diversions. But it doesn't mean that diversions don't matter. Obviously, if you fill up a bowl, you know, and you shine a light on it and it's starting to evaporate, but then you also take a drinking straw and you start sucking water out of it, which is essentially what we're doing to the Great Salt Lake, that will matter. Of course it will matter. This is like very basic. As I say, A plus B plus C. So you have the variability, you add in the climate change, you add in the diversions, and we get to a place where it probably is unsustainable, but it's not completely in our hands. Look, that's hard to hear. I want to be able to impact it.
You know what else is hard to hear? Is the fact that it took you 4 minutes to answer that last question.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that.
No. What I mean in this sense, that it's so complicated. And as a climate scientist slash journalist, you're having to convey the complications of the story. And what it seems like was happening when activists and scientists published that report, they had choices to make. And I want to talk about the choices that they had to make. Because as you say in the piece, Bonnie Baxter in particular, she's a microbiologist at Westminster University. She told you that she felt it was their responsibility to tell the public that it would have been unethical to not disclose what they were seeing. Here's the trend line. We've got to tell people about that. And yes, it may not have taken into account all of this stuff, but it seems pretty scary right now. We have an ethical obligation to do it. And it seems like the choices they had was shock the public a little bit, lean into what seems like a scary scenario, or give that elaborate, complicated answer that you just gave.
The marble mouth scientific.
No, it wasn't mouth, but it's complicated.
Yeah.
There are all these factors. It's chaos theory.
Yeah.
And so what do you make of the choice that they made to say, because you deal with this in the piece, the value of jolting the public versus just presenting a sort of more bland, nuanced version, they felt they had an ethical obligation to tell the public. I'm not sure if it's an ethical obligation to be more nuanced. Like, what do you make of the decision that they made? Because they clearly made a decision and they were upfront about all of these equivocations, by the way, that you do mention that. They weren't misleading anybody. That's clear. But
it's framing, right? It's framing.
Yeah, I guess it is.
And that is really, you know, a challenge because framing is so subjective, right? They're like, you know, I teach journalistic ethics. This is not scientific ethics, but journalistic ethics. And what I've won awards for being an ethical reporter. And one of the things that I tell my students is that the things that I have won awards for ethical reporting are the things that haunt me the most because they were the hardest decisions and actually there wasn't a right and wrong answer. Hmm. You know, like we had a choice to make. We tried to follow an ethical framework, but there are a lot of ethical principles in the journalistic code of ethics that conflict with each other. There are often two goods. There are often two bads and they conflict with each other, right? And you have to make these decisions. And so what I make of it is that they made a decision that is different than the decision that I think in the same situation I would make.
Right.
I don't think that they made the wrong decision. And I think, and this has been borne out by a lot of the comments on the stories that we published,
yeah,
is that a lot of readers go either way. And some are like, well, I'm not really sure what I would do in that situation. And I don't think any of those people are wrong. They've just done the calculus in a slightly different way. We would love to live in a world where scientists have a rule book for doing this, and this is exactly what you do. But I'll tell you, like, journalists have had this, you know, journalistic code of ethics for many, many, many years, and we still don't do things the exact same way, which is not to say we don't do things ethically. So, I think that I would have been more nuanced. I also think that the global media would not have paid any attention to me if I had written a report based on what my understanding of the science is.
So here are the two consequences of the decision that they made. As you said, global interest in Great Salt Lake. Global, certainly at New York Times, you know, I can't tell you how many the stories that we heard from these major legacy newspapers reporting on what was going on, the attention. Clearly, lawmakers were paying attention to that. Clearly, public policymakers were paying attention to all of that. So that's one consequence. The other consequence, though, is that there was a massive snow year months after the report comes out. And Governor Cox called it all a joke.
On national public radio.
On national public radio.
Not even locally, right? Like he went to national public radio and said, that was a joke. Everybody knew it was a joke.
But that's the consequence it seems like you're worried about, is if you get it wrong, it could undo respect for science, respect for the idea that climate change is real.
Yeah, there's a lot of people who, I mean, and, you know, like there's a lot of chatter that's like, oh, it was just another hoax. And part of that is people already having a preconceived notion. And you know what? Like I tell people all the time, don't argue with those people, you know. But also, there are people who strive. And I think Governor Cox strives to do this. He will be the first person to tell you that he does it imperfectly and that he's, you know, often even borders on hypocrisy when he tells people to disagree better and then he uses what he calls his farm words to criticize other people.
Right.
But he sets himself up as a fair arbiter and then he wasted no time piling on in this report. Now, the NPR interview was the meaner of the quotes. But even before that, months and months before the NPR interview, he gave a talk here at the University of Utah where he laid into climate scientists for not being nuanced and made a very, very clearly direct reference to this report from BYU. But he really says, like basically like, well, you know, scientists tell me one thing in private, but in public they say a completely different thing, you know, and they're like, they'll be very nuanced in private, but in public they're very like extreme. And I think there was I think part of it was this Great Salt Lake report.
Mm-hmm.
I think part of it was his perception of what scientists were saying during the pandemic. That wasn't quite as like directly, but I think there was sort of an undercurrent of that where, you know, he felt like the science was more nuanced, but the public positions were not. And the truth of the matter is that science is always really super nuanced. There's always vast uncertainties. And yes, if you want to ask me as a scientist, right, like, how would you communicate this or what does this mean for me? I'll give you a 4-minute answer or maybe a 40-minute answer.
Yeah.
Right. And then if you're asking me to like give you my best guess as to what we should do, well, that's a 20-second answer.
Yeah.
And we got 20-second attention spans, which kind of bites, but it is what it is.
There's a critical question you ask in the article. Let me read it. Would a more nuanced warning have gotten as much attention and spurred as much action from legislators as a report warning that desiccation might be imminent? The answer, or let me give you your answer. I'm sure you're going to give me the answer, but the way you write it in the piece is almost certainly not. Lawmakers would not have acted in the same way with a more nuanced answer.
Yeah, I mean, like, nuance is really, really hard to communicate and get people to act on.
Yeah.
I would love to live in a world where, you know, we all sit down and our better angels control the actions that we take and we really think about things and, like, we take time. But also, look, from the perspective of the people who wrote this report, right? Like, the legislative session was coming. And so, would it have gotten as much attention? Certainly as much media attention? Absolutely not, right? That five-year thing, like, that jolted a lot of people. You know, would it have been more responsible? That's an open question. That's a question that I want readers to be grappling with. That's a question I'm not sure I have an answer to because we have these dueling masters. Mm. What is the better good here? And, you know, long term, I think there has been a consequence to trust in science at the highest levels of our government and probably, you know, among people in Utah and people all across the world who saw this. Short term, I think it got people thinking about the lake, talking about the lake, talking about what they can do, probably forced some bills across the finish line that might not have gotten there otherwise. Is it a wash? I don't know.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Matthew LaPlante. He's a climate scientist and an associate professor of journalism at Utah State University. Along with Clarissa Casper, he co-authored a three-part series for the Salt Lake Tribune and Utah Public Radio about the future of the Great Salt Lake. The reporting was also produced as a series for the podcast called Undisciplined. We have links for all of that on our website, radiowest.org. Next week, we're going to have with us one of the lead scientists of the BYU report, the ecologist Ben Abbott. He'll respond to the Tribune series and give us a sense of how he's thinking about the future of the lake. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.